First, in the larger picture, why did the Senate reject the House compromise budget over the weekend?
Sure. And Jay, it is a little complex, so take a minute to explain. You know, the reality is that it's all about money. You know, we are between $7 and $8 billion in the red in the next 2 years. So what do you do about that? We've got a savings account of about $10 billion. That'll carry us through for the next 3 years, and then that savings runs out. So the true issue is, how are we going to stretch that savings out as long as possible before we have to face the reality of another alternative taxes like income tax or use of the permanent fund? And honestly, if things don't turn around in the oil industry, if they stay the way they are, we will probably be running out of savings in 3 years. So that's what this is all about. And what's happened is the Republican-controlled Senate is trying to cut the budget where they can. And, of course, that's painful. I mean, nobody wants to cut the budget. But, you know, at your house, if you have a financial problem, you find a way to reduce expenses. So that's really where we are. So $7 to $8 billion in the red in the next 2 years. And so what happened is that in order to get into our savings, that $10 billion in savings, we have to have a three-quarter vote in the House and in the Senate. Well, the Senate's okay. We've got a three-quarter vote. We passed the budget. We funded the budget fully with the three-quarter vote, taking the money out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve, our savings account. The House, unfortunately, doesn't have enough members of the majority to get that three-quarter vote. So I don't know if you want to hear all the details, Jay, but the reality is, and I've seen this now for 15 years, when you need a three-quarter vote and have to depend on the minority to get that three-quarter vote, in this case the Democrats in the House, it costs you. You've got to do some projects that they want. Well, they don't want to accept the Republican budget the way it is, and I understand that. If I was in the minority, I'd do the same thing.
Yeah, but this is a little bit old news because the House did come to an agreement amongst themselves.
They did. Truly, they did. But they did it by giving away everything that the minority wanted, which is a lot of money. So that's what all we're talking about is money.
I think the minority would say they didn't get everything they wanted. I think some of the guaranteed raises, wage increases for state employees, and I don't think all the school money was in there. I don't think it was everything they wanted.
Well, no, but it did go considerably further than the Republican majority wanted to do in the Senate. So, yeah, you're right. The disagreement at this point is frankly about the wages for state employees, the COLA, the cost of living allowance increase. And personally, I have no trouble with that, having been a state employee, a university employee, having having been under a contract, a negotiated contract. I think if you've got a negotiated contract, you need to honor it. But then you need to say, okay, but next year we need to sit down and talk about a 5%, a 15%, whatever, a reduction, 10% reduction in across the board. And always in the past, employees of the state have realized when we are in a financial exigency that they're going to have to give something on their contracts. But you don't do it when you have a contract in place, I believe, personally. So that's the main disagreement right now. You know, I think I just want to tell people, just be patient. This is going to be solved. It'll happen. It'll probably take two more weeks. We've been through this. I've been through this now for 15 sessions, and I know how it works. And this is the worst one because this is the worst financial situation we've been in, you know, with $7 to $8 billion in underfunding. So hang on. We'll find a way to do this. Right now, negotiations are going on between what's called the conference committee. So the three members of the House, three members of the Senate, and they will go to the table and they will vote things up or down. They'll go through every issue, and that's the way it's resolved. Now, the governor has offered to send in a mediator, and that's very nice of him, but, you know, the legislature is probably not going to accept that. You know, that's what legislators do, is they negotiate a budget. That's our main job. You know, that's the only job in the Constitution we have, is to come up with a budget. Now, I know people are a little upset, and they're saying, they're reading the newspaper here locally that says, you know, the ferry's going to stop running and the airport's going to close. Well, of course, none of that's going to happen. No one's going to let that happen. We are not going to close down government at the end of this month. There is a misunderstanding, though, because some people think that pink slips were sent out, and some, of course, some have, but the letter the governor sent the first of this month simply said that at the end of the month there could be pink slips. And the reality, Jay, is that there will be jobs lost. I mean, we have less money than we had before. We've just got to find a way to keep things going as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. When the governor says that what's holding everything up is such a microscopic piece of the pie, even though it's a few million dollars, 30-something, I think, he says that it pales in comparison to the actual size of the problem, that it's not going to make any difference. The argument that, well, you have to start somewhere. You know, when your household budget is in debt, like you mentioned, you got to start. But, you know, this would be, I can't do the math off the top of my head, but $36 million out of $7 billion is a very tiny amount.
Yeah, it's less than 1%, less than half of 1%.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So when he says, you know, this is less than half of 1%, why not just get done with that and then start working on the next couple of years, which are really going to be tough?
Well, the governor's right, and I think he's done a great job so far, and he is absolutely right. We need to just move beyond this, but we've got time. We've got egos involved in both the House and the Senate leadership, and they're trying to get the best advantage they can. I think in the end it'll probably be a compromise, as it always is, and it's truly not very much money. I guess what I'd like to say about this, and I know it's a little maybe a complex issue, but so we've got a $10 billion savings account. We want to stretch that out as long as we can. We know that if things go the way they are with oil production and oil prices, that will fully fund our budget for 3 years plus. So when we look at, say, whatever, $50 million or whatever it is, you have to think, well, that's just going to take a few days off the end of that savings account. You know, so we've got now, instead of 3 years, we've got 2 years, 11 months, and, you know, and three weeks or something like that. So you need to think about it that way, because I just hope folks realize that the only thing between you and an income tax is that savings account. And once that savings account is gone, the only way we can pay for government is very limited: sales tax, property tax, income tax, use of the permanent fund, and maybe a little bit of all three. You know, we have had a wonderful ride here for the 40-some years I've been in Alaska. You know, the years we've had oil money coming in, it's been tremendous. We've not have to pay taxes. We've gotten the services we want without funding it ourselves. We've got a permanent fund dividend every year, and that's been wonderful. But I just think folks need to realize that if things don't change in the oil industry, and often they have, but it doesn't look good this time. It really does not look good this time. I think we're going to be at the same place we are. And so that savings account is really the only thing saving us from disaster.
I'm getting the impression that you really see this as a sea change in life in the state of Alaska.
Well, most definitely it is, Jay. You know, I've been there now, frankly, this is my 15th year, and this is the third time I've come back home to the public and said, the sky is falling, oil prices have dropped once again, and we are in a serious situation. Twice before, And then we come back and say, well, we got to talk about income tax or this or that. And twice before we've done that, and then all of a sudden oil has changed around, and we're back in the money again. This time is not like that. I mean, if you look at world oil prices, if you look at the issues in Saudi Arabia and around the Middle East, they seem to want to keep the prices fairly low, and they're willing to pump a lot of oil in order to do that. So it's a different world than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Going back to the situation in the Senate with addressing what has come out of the House or in the conference committee, well, specifically what came out of the House, are you, as part of the majority and all the other majority caucus members, are you guys bound to all vote the same way on this? Is that why there's no cracks, no dissent there?
Well, that is true. I mean, if you join the majority. And I've got to say, being in the majority is much better than being in the minority. The things we have in Kodiak that have been, when I'm on my watch, have occurred because I was in the majority. The $30 million that went into Pier 2, you know, that's only there because we were in the majority and able to be a part of the bonding issue that got that for us, as well as things around the state. So, frankly, I mean, I would never want to be in the minority, because you really can't help your community very much if you're in the minority. So there are two things you have to do if you're in the majority, and you can leave at any time. As you know, one of the representatives voted the wrong way, and she was tossed out of the majority on the House side. Now, that could happen here, too. And maybe there's a moral issue and an ethical issue where you say, I can't vote with that. I can't do that, so I'm going to choose to leave the majority and be in the minority. I know it's a little complicated and folks don't really understand it too much, but it is true that one of the things you promise to do if you're going to be in the majority, and if you don't do them, you leave, you go to the minority. And one of the things you promise to do is to vote for the budget. It's a very complicated process. It's negotiated. And in the end, if you want to stay in the majority, you vote for the budget. So the budget will pass. There will be 11 votes to pass the budget. There are 15 members of our majority. You know, four people could drop out and choose not to vote for the budget. But that's probably unrealistic. You know, you need to have a budget. You need to move ahead. And you need to find a way to compromise. And as I say, we've always found a way to compromise. We give in a little here. The other side gives in a little. No one's ever exactly happy with what the budget looks like. But that's just the democratic process that we have.
This is the third year since you haven't been Senate President, right? Third session?
Yes.
Would we be having these kind of problems if you're still Senate President under these current financial conditions?
That's a nice question. And you know, of course, the truth of the matter is when I was Senate President, we had 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans. We had 20 members of the Senate. So it was a bipartisan. It had both Democrats and Republicans in the majority. That's the way it works. That's the way it has to work. And I was really pleased to be able to be there for 4 years. And actually, you know, the great thing was that we had lots of money. Oil was high. And we were able to stuff, at that time, actually, we stuffed $16 billion into savings. If we hadn't done that, we would be in a sorry state right now. So I don't know that I probably wouldn't, I'm not going to say that things would be better off if I were president because it was a different time. I had a bipartisan coalition. We worked together very closely between Democrats and Republicans. And the people in the minority at that time were the far right, you know, And now those are the people that really are controlling the Senate majority. So most of the folks from the Valley, but from elsewhere. And I find it personally, you know, a little hard to work with because I'm more of a moderate and more in the moderate Republican. And so it's been a little harder for me this year.
So but if tomorrow you replace Kevin Meyer, would we still be in this morass?
Honestly, I don't think so. I mean, I like to think that I'm able to get people together and reach a conclusion and find a way to moderate things and to make people as happy as we can, but realize that no one's ever going to be perfectly happy. But yeah, I think there's probably just a different approach that I have than the last two presidents have had.
Yeah. This is kind of a sensitive question. I don't want to upset you. I don't want to sound insensitive. You were in the leadership before you were the president. Like you said, you wielded a lot of power. There was, you know, good money coming back to Kodiak. The 2 years that you were out of the presidency, you were the chair of the Education Committee. And this year you were down to the Legislative Committee, which is an important committee. But do you feel like these people are maybe taking out on you, taking revenge maybe on you for being a moderate leader and, you know, bringing in all those 10 Democrats for all those years? Because your predecessor did the same thing, I recall, when you were the majority leader.
Right.
Do you think that they're trying to marginalize you?
Well, that's a good question and deserves an honest answer. My problem with both my party and with the majority of the Senate is frankly my position on Senate Bill 21. I myself and only two Republicans voted against Senate Bill 21, which gave a lot of tax advantages to big oil. I voted against it. I believe that it was a mistake. I don't think we should be doing that, but we did. And actually, then it went to a vote of the public, and the public in Alaska said, we like Senate Bill 21. It didn't pass in Kodiak. It didn't pass in Homer. It didn't pass in Cordova. So I think, you know, what you hope is that you will represent and you understand and you vote the way your public wants you to vote. And I believe we were on very strong ground. It was a mistake, I think, to pass Senate Bill 21. And frankly, just so you know, it's put me in a bad position in the Republican Party, the statewide Republican Party, as well as in the past leadership. But now I've worked my way back into a major position. You know, the Legislative Council Chairman is very, very powerful. It runs the legislature during the interim. It's responsible for all of the buildings we own and all of the staff. That the attorneys and the researchers and all of that. So it is a very important, and I'm really glad to do that. And I think maybe I'm working myself back into a better position in the majority.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the effects of SB 21 and the you know the public vote on it, just that whole giving the changing that dynamic, is contributing to the situation we're in now?
Yeah, well, that's a good fair question, too. You know, the governor, when he ran for office, said we have got to look at the credits we are giving big oil. We are giving big oil, not just big oil, but little oil, too. I mean, all of the oil companies, we are giving them more credits for exploration and development than we are getting in taxes, in production taxes. So that's true. Giving more production credits than we are getting in production taxes. And that's not good. I mean, we own the resource. We want to make sure that we're getting our value out of it. The oil is and all the natural resources is something we need to benefit from. Now, when you add in other things, though, like corporate taxes and royalty fees and those sorts of things, we still are making money off of our oil. So it's not really fair to say Senate Bill 21 has been a failure. In some sense, it's worked. If prices were to go way high again, $110, $150, we would be at a real disadvantage compared to ACES, the prior tax plan. So the jury's still out. You know, there are people who say that Senate Bill 21 has been a success and it's worked. Well, maybe it's worked when we're at low oil prices, but it certainly would not work if we ever get back to high oil prices.
Let me ask about the permanent fund. You mentioned, you know, people are talking about tapping the permanent fund. Aren't they talking about, or shouldn't they be talking about, using earnings reserve? There's the earnings on the corpus of the permanent fund. A percentage of that goes to inflation-proofing the corpus. Portion is used for the PFD. And then there's the surplus, the stuff that's left over from the money that the permanent fund makes. And as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're not required to put that money back into the corpus. Isn't that the money that the state should be looking at spending?
Well, you know, that's a big issue, and a lot of folks don't quite understand. It was a little too clever, I think, what the plans were to move funds from the earnings reserve into the corpus, and then thereby reducing the amount available, and then that only requires a majority vote to go into the constitutional budget reserve. But a little too clever, and there's too much opposition to that. I know in the House, several legislators have sent a letter saying, six of them saying, we absolutely will never take money out of the permanent fund in any event, either the permanent fund or the earnings reserve of the permanent fund. I agree, and there are enough of us in the Senate who agree that we should leave the permanent fund alone until the voters tell us to. I mean, I think that's a very strong message I've gotten ever since I've been in the legislature, is leave the permanent fund alone. And if you ever need to use it, if we ever get to the point where we're running out of money, then come to us, the public, and ask permission. Because, you know, people will have to make that decision, I think, at some point. Would I rather have an income tax, or would I rather have a use of the permanent fund? That's going to be a tough decision on folks, and it depends on where you are financially and what kind of jobs you have, which is to your advantage. So that was an idea that was floated and had some support, but not enough support to get through either house. Mm-hmm. Use of the earnings of the permanent fund is simply a no-go this year.
Hmm. See, that to me, that's just crazy. I mean, it's being inflation-proofed. It's still making money. Honestly, I guess I don't know how much money it makes per year. I mean, it's $60-some billion dollars. How big is the earnings reserve right now?
So the amount of money in the earnings reserve is pretty substantial, and I think maybe it's $12, $15 billion.
Oh, okay. Still not a permanent solution to the situation we've got going on.
No. Yeah. It would solve the immediate problem, which is to get into the corpus, into the constitutional budget reserve, mm-hmm, without a three-quarter vote.
Yeah.
But that's a little too clever, and I think folks are a little concerned about it.
Yeah, and that was an idea out of the House, right? That was the House's idea when they couldn't get the three-quarters vote?
The House and the Senate, both the finance committees bounced it around. They looked at the legal issue of whether we could do it, and legally, with the way the three-quarter vote is written, and that was written probably 20 years ago, it takes three-quarter votes to get into the savings. And actually, that was designed by when the Democrats were in charge, and they wanted to protect it, and so here we are still protecting that three-quarter vote. You know,
probably a good idea.
I think it is a good idea. Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah, exactly. It keeps our little hands off off the savings account.
Yeah. Remind me, who is the woman who's co-chair of Senate Finance?
Senate Finance, Anna Faircloth.
Anna Faircloth, yeah. Right. You know,
McKinnon now.
McKinnon.
Just recently married.
Okay. That makes sense now.
That's caused some confusion. Yeah.
It has for me, too. I was thinking, well, where's Anna Faircloth? But, you know, I've always known her, not known her, reading about her, watching her on the Gavel TV or on the news and such. And, you know, she's a fiscal hawk, it appears, which is fine. But the impression I get, and let me run this by you, do you think that some folks, fiscal hawks, conservatives, people more conservative than yourself, are taking this opportunity to... this financial crisis we're in, taking this opportunity to defund, weaken, do away with programs that they never liked in the first place? One of the things I'm thinking about is public broadcasting, but, you know, there are others out there. What do you think? Are they using this to their advantage for their purposes?
Well, you know, I think there are folks in the Senate and in the House who very strongly believe that we have let things go astray, that we are spending too much money, that we've wasted money, that we need to pull back. And so I'm not going to really answer the question about Anna Faircloth.
Or in general.
In general. But
just the conservatives and hawks in general in the legislature as a whole.
I think there's some truth of that, and I see that in terms of education. I see people who are willing to really want to defund education. They want to go to say a voucher system where we damage public education. And my belief is that I'm such a strong believer in public education. It's really what has made this country. It's provided my education, my children's education. You know, it's given us what we are today. So it's given us democracy. You know, so I think it's really important that we maintain a very strong public education system. And there's nothing wrong with private education. And I certainly support that, and if people want to send their kids to a private school, that's great. They can do that, but they need to pay for it. You know, we have a responsibility. It's in our Constitution to support public education, and we just need to maintain that.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you that the education is one of the areas that you know, along with the public broadcasting, that I think that you know is on the radar of you know the budget hawks or the social conservatives, what have you. So do you think that maybe some folks are taking advantage of the situation to, you know, weaken those things?
Well, I think a lot of people have ulterior motives, and often I don't know what they are, and often they don't say exactly what they are. But it is a shame if you make use of the power you have to damage public institutions.
Mm-hmm. What's the holdup with Aaron's Law?
No, that's a really important issue. I've supported Aaron's Law right from the beginning. It's a wonderful bill, and what it says is that children need to learn very early on as an age appropriate level about good touch, bad touch. You know, we have the worst record in the United States for sexual abuse of children, and so Aaron's Law, and also a piece of that was added, had to do with teenagers and. The young woman was
dating violence.
Yeah, dating violence. Young woman was killed in the valley by a boyfriend. And yeah, so those two are two very strong things that we need to take care of. So I was in the House or in the Senate Education Committee, and Senator Dunleavy added several pieces to that bill. I like the bill the way it was, the simple bill. He added several pieces to it. Some things I don't really agree with, and so when that bill left Education Committee, I did the only thing I could do, which is to sign that it be amended. And now the bill is in Senate Finance, and I think we'll see an amendment soon that will take out a lot of the things that were added into it. I mean, I think most folks say, why can't we just pass this? Frankly, I got to say, I'm a little annoyed when I heard some opposition to it from the school districts who said it's an unfunded mandate, and they're right. I mean, there's no money attached to the bill to help pay for it, but frankly, you know, I guess about half the schools in Alaska are already doing it. You know, they already are training kids on Safe Touch. And the Rasmussen Foundation has stepped forward and said, we will help pay for textbooks and materials and training and online training, as well as educating teachers to how to deal with that in the school. So, you know, one of the things that's in that bill that was added the last minute in Senate Education was to make it optional for school districts. I don't think it should be optional. I think we should say, listen, we fund education very heavily, and we should say, you know, just do it. Just provide that education to kids, and I'm sure most teachers would love to see that happen. It's probably the administrators who are saying, well, we don't have the money to do it, but we give you lots of money, so just find a way to do it.
Do you think it's going to be one of the things that are passed before you guys are done here this year, this session?
It looks good. It looks pretty good. You know, now that it is in Senate Finance, they are talking about it. They are working on a committee substitute, which, as I understand it, would go back pretty much to the original bill. There are some other things they may add into it, and some of them I like, some I don't like. We'll see how that turns out.
You know, when the session was about to start or in its early days, I interviewed you, and you seemed optimistic about Medicaid expansion. That seems to have floundered. I'm getting the impression that it's another one of those things that, the folks who are more conservative than you just would rather not do because it's Obamacare.
All right. And I'm still optimistic about Medicaid expansion. The governor thinks it's a good idea. His staff, his commissioner of health and social services is very positive and believes that it, in fact, will save money. It'll cover a lot of people who do not have coverage. It'll release a lot of the folks that are going to emergency wards and hospitals and have them do some pre-medical things so they know what the problems are before they occur and what they do to solve them. So I still think it's a good idea. It's not on the call for this special session. We will deal with it, but it'll probably be like in September, October, something like that. I believe we'll have a special session to deal with Medicaid expansion. I think that'll happen. It's very complex, and the folks, and most folks that I talk to here in Cordova and Homer here in Kodiak, most folks think it's a really good idea and would like to see it explored. Well, we don't know the answers yet. We have to really get into it, get into the details, and find out what really it means and what the cost would be, and would there be exceptional costs that we don't want. We do know it brings in federal monies. We do know that it would hire personnel that would have jobs. So on the whole, it looks to me very, very positive. But we don't know the answers yet. We really have to delve into the details, find out exactly what it means. So I think that'll be done sometime in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Don't I recall that the governor did put Medicare expansion on the call for the special session, but you guys gabbled out,
session,
and then you guys had your own special session.
That's
now.
True. That's
and
true.
And it's not on
it's
there.
It's not on
so,
that
okay.
call.
Yeah. The voters, a number of years ago, put in the 90-day session. We've talked about this before. You've never been a fan. Would a 120-day session have helped this year, or would it just have extended the misery?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I do like 120 days better. Folks are, the public did vote for a 90-day session. Still, the Constitution says 120 days, so we have that option if we need to. And a few times we've gone over 90 days, and it's perfectly legal, and everything we passed over that 90 days, the attorneys say are legal, and no one can challenge that. Those things, those laws will still hold water. So I prefer the 120 days, but the public had a chance, and they said 90 days. Well, I think if the public had said, how about a weekend? Get it done in a weekend. I think that might have passed as well. But the reality is that democracy just takes time. You and I can sit here and make a decision very quickly, but probably fairly quickly. But when you get 20 senators and 40 representatives, and you have to go through all the steps and all the meetings and all the hearings and hear from the public and move through all the committees, it just takes time. And I think that 90 days is just a little too short, personally.
Mm-hmm. The question was, would 120 days have solved the problem this year or just added to the misery?
Well, yeah, that I'm not really sure of. But I think we would have addressed Medicaid expansion if we had 120 days. I think that would have been added to the list of things that we tried to accomplish anyway. Mm. And one thing I should say is people are always saying, we want to go to 90 days because you cost too much if you go to 120 days. But the reality is that legislators receive a salary no matter what, whether we're in session or out of session. So it doesn't make any difference in terms of salary.
So basically 90 days is a raise.
Some members of the House I've talked to really like the 90 days because they can spend more time at home.
Yeah. I watch a lot of Gavel to Gavel. I got a new TV set up above my desk, so I watch Gavel to Gavel all session. And I noticed every day that I watched, you know, there'd be some hearings in the morning or something, but then there would be the floor sessions. And every day, in both the House and the Senate, there was introduction of guests, mm-hmm. which is very nice for those people, I imagine. However, I did a little math in my head, and that was 5 hours a week.
You're probably right. Yeah.
Roughly, maybe 4.5 hours a week between the two bodies. And that's a little bit of time.
Yeah. Well, realize that most things take place off the floor. Most discussions in committee, in the public, but still in the public, but off the floor. And so the floor sessions are just very formal. And of course, you know, we always never talk about the House. We talk about the other body. We always talk about my honorable friend from Nome or whatever, you know. So it's the tradition of the Senate is not to be nasty on the floor, not to get into fistfights on the floor, and to try to make it as respectful as possible. So sometimes it does appear as if the only thing we've got going on is introduction of guests, and that's just the reality of it. But you know, it's also a good thing. I mean, because if you were there and you were introduced on the floor of the Senate, you would be in the permanent record of the state of Alaska. You would be there. Your name would be there. It'll always be there. And that's sort of nice thing to know, that you're respected, you're recognized, and you're honored for your presence. So it takes time, that's true, but it's time that's frankly well spent.
Yeah. Do I get a pin? Do you hand out little pins?
I would give you a pin if you were to come down.
Well, Senator Gary Stevens, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you, sir.